Okay, today we have heard a lot about the disclosure initiative, and one project in the disclosure initiative is this practice statement on materiality. And today, I think we have issued it, was last week?
Yes, last week.
So you had plenty of time to read it. And the question is, okay, how useful?
We actually issued it early to the group.
Oh, yeah.
Extra time to read.
Oh,
2 days extra.
Even better.
Chris, did you want all my comments?
Yes, actually.
So I think Christy will give us a short, or the team, short intro. Ashley will give us a short intro, and then we had some questions.
Okay, no problem. We just thought we'd give a brief introduction, and then we have some questions for you to answer. So the main purpose of this session is to get your feedback. In particular, do you find it a useful tool? And if anything is missing, should we add it in, or if there's anything that should come out? Just to give you some background, the materiality practice statement is part of the overall disclosure initiative, as Martin said. So we aren't looking at the definition in this practice statement. The definition will be looked at in the principles of disclosure discussion paper, which I think is coming out towards the end of Q1 next year.
Yeah.
And that will discuss whether there's any need to change the definition. But this practice statement is based on the current definitions that we have in the conceptual framework IS1 and IS8. So we don't envision any particular differences between what we're proposing in the practice statement and what will be proposed in the principles of disclosure discussion paper, but just to flag it up that this isn't about the definition. So we're undertaking a project on materiality following the discussion forum on financial reporting that happened in January 2013, and there was a survey that went with that. And part of the feedback that we received was that materiality wasn't always applied correctly, and this was leading in some cases to too much irrelevant information, and in other cases not enough relevant information. And there was two types of difficulties in particular reported, and this was the management and preparers were unsure how to apply the concept of materiality, in that the disclosure requirements in IFRS were often seen as requirements that had to be fulfilled, and this led to a kind of checklist approach. And in another sense, this checklist approach was perceived as time-saving and made it easier for dealing with auditors and regulators when you didn't have to explain why you hadn't followed a regulation, when in fact it was just immaterial. So following all this, and after discussion with the board and outreach, including we've previously spoken about the problems that we perceived with materiality with the GPF, we decided to issue guidance. We felt that this would help alleviate the over-reliance on the quantitative aspects of materiality and lead to better application of judgment. In particular, the better application of judgment when it comes to presentation on the face of the financial statements and in the notes. In the end, we've decided to go with a practice statement rather than authoritative guidance or educational guidance. So a practice statement is somewhere in between. It's non-authoritative guidance, which can be mandated by a jurisdiction. So if a jurisdiction wants to make it mandatory, then it can. The fact that it's non-mandatory or isn't mandated by the IASB doesn't remove the requirement to fulfill the materiality requirements that are in IS1 and IS8. And obviously, if a jurisdiction has materiality requirements, then they will be required to fulfill that. So the objective of the practice statement is really to assist management in applying the concept. We also had a secondary objective of hoping that users and auditors and regulators would understand where preparers have come from, so it would be a useful tool for preparers when they're having discussions with auditors and regulators to say, well, we relied on the practice statement and this is why we came to this decision. So hopefully it achieves those objectives. So just quickly, I know you've all read it, but we've broken down the practice statement into kind of three sections. So we have the general characteristics of materiality, and we hope that this section will just help the reader to understand what we're talking about when we mean materiality, and in particular to distinguish it, I suppose, from audit materiality, which is a different thing. And then how we perceive materiality to be, or how you use materiality when you're talking about the presentation and disclosure of financial statements, and then in recognition and measurement. And then we've also got a section on omissions and misstatements. So we heard that this was a problem. This is an area where people find it particularly difficult to apply materiality. As I'm sure you're aware, the FASB have recently proposed to change their guidance on materiality. So what they're proposing at this stage is still only a proposal, but they say that it's a legal concept, and they're going to follow the US Supreme Court decision on that one. So at the moment, we have, so foreign filers are already using IFRS and US GAAP. Currently, our definition is in CON 8, and so we share a definition between our conceptual framework and the CON 8, and we haven't been aware of any entity that has had difficulty. That's not to say that there isn't, but we aren't aware of any at the moment that this is where this has caused difficulty. Obviously, our practice statement won't override any national or jurisdictional guidance on materiality, so long as that guidance is in accordance with IFRS. So, yes, we have some questions for you, which are included on in the cover note, which I have put. So the first one we want to ask is, do you think the guidance will be understandable by and helpful to preparers of financial statements?
Should we answer any questions isolated or because of what you have preferred?
Or whatever you prefer.
Okay.
It's what we do.
Yeah, because I think it's related, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Then we... Will you read the questions, the rest, or should we... I think we have already, right? Okay, we can start the discussion then.
Start as usual.
Okay, then Kevin.
I think here you have a nice opportunity to actually be explicit, as opposed to talking in the, you know, in the implicit. And I quite like the examples that you gave, because that was helpful in being explicit, because it. You know, a lot of the IFRS standards, because they've got to apply worldwide and everything, they tend to have airy-fairy language. If you get a bit explicit here, it could be very, very useful. In the introduction, I'd like you to eliminate the word... Management's good in the document. In the introduction, if you can actually make more reference to preparers and users to help them understand how the preparers have applied. Because... colleagues on the right, if you say this is the guidance to assist management, yeah, well, it's not guidance to assist auditors, so I don't care. You know, this is really to help preparers understand. One big improvement which will come out of the South African comment letter, what would be really useful is some type of recommendation that I put into my critical estimates and judgments how I have assessed materiality, and therefore, as a consequence, have not complied with the disclosure requirements of ABC standards, but have applied the accounting principles inherent within those standards. Now, that way, for those of us who've got, well, like if I look at us, we've got, out of 60,000 employees, we've got 1,300 actives on the defined benefit fund and 2,000 pensioners, like. And the cost is $60 million a year on revenue of $5 billion. You know, any mathematic I want to use, it's immaterial. Any numbers of employees I want to use is immaterial. So to be able to say I've not complied with IAS 19 because I've concluded it's not material, and therefore the regulator knows why it's not there, the user knows why it's not there, and I can give some paragraph about 1,300 members, 2,000 pensioners, cost of $60 million, oh yeah, fine, tick. You know, it closes the loop, as opposed to, well, you didn't put it in, why not? You know, solve the why not question as part of a recommendation on how you'd implement the practice standard.
Mm-hmm.
Would you want that for every single standard that you didn't apply? So
well, at the moment, put it this way. Well, no, because those are not applicable to me, because I don't have those already. But it took, if I take like last year, the ISB's financial statements stopped 2 years ago listing all the standards that had come out. So it took until your second year for me to get my auditors to agree that I don't have to do it. So I already am not on that page. But if there's a standard that's obvious I should have applied, like pensions and share-based payments and all that other stuff, but I've chosen not to because it didn't meet my materiality criteria, then I've got a disclosure requirement, and it's closed the loop from the questioners of the regulator.
I'm having trouble envisaging what that would look like, to be honest, because I don't think you're going to be in a position where you're going to say every disclosure in IS 19 is immaterial in the sort of case you're talking about.
Well, I might do then abridged. You know, I won't have, I have abridged my narrative. Let's take IS 19. I would say I've applied these materiality criteria, and as a consequence, I have provided abridged or condensed, and I've chosen how I've chosen to abridge or condense. Because if we're going to go down the principles of disclosure route to its ultimate objective, that's where we're likely to finish up. Because it's not going to be an all or nothing situation, in my view, of where the principles of disclosure is going to finish.
Well, that's why I'm struggling to see what you're actually going to put in that's not just going to end up being boilerplate and say I haven't given every single one that's listed in the standard.
Well, I operate in 10 countries, and in those and I have 4 different defined benefit plans.
I understand how you might get to the judgment that you're not going to give all the disclosures.
Yeah.
But I'm really struggling to see what you would say about how you've come to the conclusions you've come to. That's not just going to end up with a massive boilerplate.
Would the ideal scenario be that if it's not in the financial statements, then it's evident that it's not material?
Up until this year, I might have said yes. But my questions from the SEC and my questions from the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, I had to explain why it wasn't there, because it wasn't material.
Yeah,
because
that
they're
is
going down the checklist, and therefore I want to avoid that by putting it in to my critical estimates and judgments. I've answered the question before I get it.
But that is a part of our approach, because we think, okay, that the problem of disclosure overload is a kind of behavioral, and we have to not only to change behavior of preparers, we have also to change the behavior of the regulators and maybe of the auditors then,
yeah.
Because everybody has to move into that direction, otherwise we will not achieve.
Yeah. And that's why I say, I think first prize of me leading by saying, I did consider it, and this is why it's not there.
I think if you're going to suggest that in your comment letter, it would really help the team.
The sort of words.
If you supply an example of what you think it would actually look like in practice.
Yeah.
Okay, Malcolm.
I mean, first of all, I think it's great that you're tackling this issue. It's a challenging issue, but I have to say I have one fundamental issue, and that this is the interaction of your paragraphs 4 to 6. You say that materiality, if I understand this right, materiality as used by, say, our lawyers for reporting material information to our shareholders, or we need to do a press release or whatever, is the same as the materiality in our financial statements. Well, I completely disagree with that, actually. You know, if we use the materiality that we use for making a sort of ad hoc disclosure, you know, say we have an impairment charge or whatever, we might, in our particular case, say we only need to make an ad hoc disclosure if we have an impairment, I don't know, of $250 million or something. I can't imagine that we'd ever get our auditors to accept that their threshold for adjusting our financial statements is around about $250 million. You know, so I really have problems with that. I don't know if you want to comment on that. I've got some follow-on points, but that strikes me as being a fundamental difference about what materiality is.
What paragraph is that, Malcolm?
Hmm?
What paragraph?
46.
Four, 4, 5, and 6, you know, general character.
4, 5, and 6.
Isn't that my understanding?
I think what we're trying to say
four,
there
two,
is that ultimately,
yeah. Four, two, six.
The notion of materiality
I thought
is a notion that crosses many types of decisions in different contexts, and ultimately it's a decision about whether you include or exclude information. And that's the similarity we're trying to get.
But I don't think, I mean, with respect, I don't think you can...
Maybe we have to work on the wording, but I think the idea was, okay, materiality is not only applied in financial statements, it is also materiality applied in your day-to-day other things, and that is the comparison, I think, is...
Yeah, but the problem is it's nowhere near the same threshold of materiality.
Yeah, but it's not saying, maybe it is, I think we have to clarify the words, but you can have different thresholds, but the concept of materiality is applied also in other situations.
Materiality it's a decision, ultimately, and it's the decision or the concept that you use to make a decision, and that decision's about whether to include or exclude. A threshold is a way of helping you make that decision, but ultimately the concept of materiality is that decision, and that's what those paragraphs are.
Okay, well, I have to say it only came out relatively recently, so. And then on a more detailed level, I mean, perhaps I've got other points, but I would have thought you needed a whole section related to, I don't know, related parties or management, transactions with management, where, to my mind, you know, that's more to do with the stewardship of the company, for example, and you might say that, you know, I would have thought the threshold for reporting related party transactions or transactions with management is substantially different to figures that go into the financials. So I'm not quite sure how you're thinking through that sort of. I don't think there's one. What I'm saying is there's not one level of materiality. In my view, but other people might disagree.
I don't think that's what this is saying. I think that it's saying as you evaluate your precision in your accounting transactions and recognition of accounting transactions and different types of disclosures, you may have a different materiality threshold on a quantitative basis that's based on whether or not that information could influence a user's decision-making process. So, you know, you would expect the user to expect our underlying sales transactions are recorded and reported at a very precise level, but whether or not we capitalize an asset would be, you know, you would expect a materiality threshold to be applied, and whether or not we disclose something would again have a different materiality threshold, whether or not it was important to the users. Certainly related party transactions, I think, would be more important to users to understand what sort of governance process you have. So I don't think it's saying that there's one number, but it's the theory applied in many different scenarios.
Yeah, but maybe related parties is a good example which we can add to demonstrate that. Maybe that it
is
not numbers,
right?
It is based on the objective.
I mean, think of the situation where $5 million, let's say in the context of financial statements, is completely immaterial, right? But a $5 million loan was made to a CEO.
That is material.
There you go.
So that should, I'm not sure if I missed something, but I think you should.
Yeah, there's a mention in paragraph 28, but you know, maybe it's not prominent enough.
Okay, Zandra?
That was.
Yeah. Kevin, again?
And maybe I'm, and I probably am, misinterpreting paragraph 19, but it worries me that someone might interpret that taking institutional investors or a separate class from retail investors. Now, I've got 20,000 shareholders, of which 16,000 hold less than 1,000 shares. I'm really not going to consider them in their individual capacity on a materiality criteria. You know, they're far too insignificant in terms of the total. But when you use these words, when I first read it, I sort of go, do you mean Class A versus Class B ords, or do you mean institutional and retail? Because it was a bit confusing to me.
What we were trying to say is that ultimately you have to make that judgment. So if you thought a certain class were immaterial and their needs weren't, if you're going to meet them, wouldn't be material, looking at the classes across a whole and the different types of users that you have, then you wouldn't necessarily need to meet that specific need. And that's what we're trying to get at, because you've got to make that judgment.
I think it's the words in the parentheses, because it says a class with a large number of users. You know, it's like
any other comments?
Can I ask broadly whether you would think this is a useful tool? Because ultimately we prepared this to help people understand what we mean by the term materiality in IFRS, and whether it would be useful in, say, having those discussions with the SEC or your local regulator, enable to structure or to provide some basis or some reason behind the thinking for those types of discussions.
I find it useful because it's give the overall idea that something is material if the users will change their idea about the investment. That is a principal idea for me of materiality. The details that is given in the notes is evidence, I would say. It does not have changed the view I had before. So it's just that maybe for some people it could have. The major thing for me is that you just remind that materiality is, does the user will have changed his view.
I think the proof of the pudding would be, would anybody really think you can change your disclosure based on this practice statement, or have you always applied this materiality notion in how it is now stated in this practice statement, or
what we
so it is confirming, or is it
what we decided before I left South Africa was we're going to do it as a test case at our accounting standards committee and see whether we can get onto a page where actually this is going to be useful by running it as a test on our set of financials.
Yeah.
So we hopefully that will, in our comment letter coming back, it'll see where, hang on though, you're pushing it too far. You know, where can we push the boundary to in eliminating or condensing certain disclosures?
What would be a result that leads you to think it is useful, and what would be a result to think it's not? Because people have asked us, we've spoken to users on this, and they said, well, what's going to be the impact on financial statements? And we can't say, because ultimately what this is meant to do is to help people make a judgment or exercise that judgment. It will only be one part of the tool, because obviously you need to apply that in the context of IFRS requirements as well. But it'd be interesting to know what you think would be a result which would mark success.
Thickness decline. Because the primaries will be the same answers. It's just that will I have, if I take it our case, you know, 7 pages of disclosures on pensions and 11 pages of disclosures on share-based payments and no disclosures on rehabilitation and decommissioning obligations, which is my biggest potential future liability. You know, it's like, let's get to the relevant discussions as opposed to in understanding the business.
Because I was going to put my hope again, that perhaps a measure of success would be if the SEC or your regulator did ask you a question about materiality, you'd feel more comfortable having that discussion with them and feel you were on solid ground because you had something common to discuss. You'd hope perhaps that they didn't ask you that question because they've maybe brought into this idea as well. And I'm wondering whether our initial hope when we prepared this was that this would aid those discussions, and we can't see much beyond whether it would actually then reduce or expand what the actual financial statements would look like, but what would be there would be more effective and be a better reflection of what's material. That's my
the last thing I want is a letter from the regulator saying, please explain why you included this because we don't think it's material. I don't want those letters from the regulator. I'm more comfortable arguing why I have not put something in because it's not material, and then telling me I've included irrelevant information.
Yeah.
We if I may, I mean, we have had that discussion in the past that sometimes you have to, there's a lot of effort in documenting why you think something is immaterial. And perhaps we as preparers have been lazy to say, well, rather than go through the documentation and discussion with our auditors why we're not disclosing something, let's just throw it in anyway. So that's a bit of a chicken and egg thing. But how do we get to the situation that we can, you know, prima facie say that disclosure for us is immaterial and we're not going to evaluate it at all? It's rather defeating the object if we have to behind the scenes do an assessment whether it's material or not and then end up not disclosing it. I mean, that's actually work, more work than disclosing it.
Yeah, that's the problem, and having spent a lot of time on this as a 30-year preparer, ultimately judgment never goes away, but the go between this and the IS-1 changes from about a year ago give you the wherewithal to say, it's okay if it's immaterial, no matter if we write it shall or must or will or minimum or whatever. So it's an enabler. I mean, I suppose the burden of proof is always going to prevail what is or is not material. But we've we've done as good a job as we can between what we wrote a year ago and this to say, if it's immaterial, you can just push it aside. You've got to prove it's immaterial, I suppose. But we certainly heard plenty of time, even if it's immaterial, if it's in a minimum you shall disclose, you have to do it. But I think the other thing we did here, we did a lot of things in here, but quite frankly, I wish this went further in some cases myself, but, you know, it's a very good document put out, is focusing on primary shareholder groups and saying the isolated, irrational shareholder, well, it could influence them, but you can discount those. You know, I think that's helpful. I mean, because I said, well, it could affect somebody, and you know, the auditors have come at you and says, well, if it's somebody as in singular, it doesn't matter. It's shareholder, stakeholders as a group. You know, I think narrowing that down helps. And there's a lot of little helps in here. But we've said repeatedly, I think, right, Christy, is this is mostly behavioral than it is necessarily technical.
Is there anything we could put in here that would make it easier for you to get over that documentation point? So, if there was some example we could put in that were kind of common situation that meant you didn't have to document it individually yourself because you could point to sort of generic guidance. Is there anything of that kind that we could somehow find to build in here?
The only thing you could put in, Peter, you can't put in, and that's a bright line.
Yeah.
And you can't put that in, and so we're going to have to document it just to prove the negative. But once you prove the negative once, the second year is that much simpler, because you've established your internal bright line.
That is true.
But we've got to debate that first.
And also the materiality may change the context in which you are. So we look at the information we give every half year, as we publish the half year, and each time we share with the auditors what we continue to give, or what we stop to give, or what we give you. It depends
on
the context as well.
So, where you have put something in that's already useful is that materiality assessments is this year. So the fact that it was material last year, I can drop. It does mean I have to consider whether, because it's material this year, do I need to put in a comparative? I really would not want.
Or a reduced comparative, you know.
Yeah.
But
a very reduced comparative. But the fact that if it's not material this year, I can drop the comparative, that's good, because I have lots of stupid notes. Because we're US filers, I have 3 years, you know, and that is really stupid when the auditor's making me put 2 years ago business combination when I haven't had one.
What if it's material to trend, not to this
it's
year?
It's still available in last year's financials. Do the trend yourself. Users are taught to read.
It's material to trend in this financial statement, though, not in another document.
It's in last year's annual
report.
Doesn't
matter. It's not in this document, this legal document.
No, it's in last year's
report. You're not incorporating by reference, are you, the prior year's financial statements into this year's 10K, are you? Or 20F?
No, but the comparative primer is there. If you want the detail of the note for that comparative primary, go and get it in last year.
Why would you even think to go there, though?
Because you're an investor, you should be looking for trends. If you're an investor not looking for trends and doing single investment, your poor investment advice is no reason to sue me.
The one thing I was going to mention, actually, to Kevin's point.
That was coming.
And I don't want to go into it in detail, but to Kevin's point in paragraph 19 about classes of shareholders, what I think would be very interesting, commend your attention, was a Delaware court's decision a week ago in the case dealing with Facebook and the duties of a majority shareholder to inform minority shareholders about certain actions. I thought it was quite interesting. And it has actually a bearing, I think, quite relevant to paragraph 19 and the comment that Kevin made earlier.
Any other comments?
Can I ask one specific question? We've had some pushback about this being non-mandatory, non-authoritative guidance. Do you have a preference either way on that?
I think you're going to have to do it that way because you've got certain regulators that have a regulatory defined materiality, and so you would be creating conflict.
It's a NIFRIC.
NIFRIC.
A NIFRIC.
Okay.
Not an IFRIC.
Sorry,
it's a NIFRIC.
Sandra, when you said you'd have to do it that way, you mean it would have to be non-mandatory.
Right.
That's what I thought, John.
Okay. Then thank you very much. And I think before we finish the public session, Malcolm, want to say?
Yes, indeed. We've got a couple of GPF members that are here, I think, for the last time. Bo, I think, is the first person I want to mention. I'm correct. He's been with us, I believe, since the beginning. So is that now 8 years or 9 years? I forget, a long time ago now. And the second one is Hiroshi. Not been with us quite so long, but many thanks for your attendance. So all the best for the future. Thank you.
Okay, then thank you very much for coming to London, participating in that meeting, giving us advice, input, and have all a safe trip back.